Bob Dylan's song, Blowing in the Wind, sung here by Peter, Paul, and Mary, ask a timeless question. How many times must a cannonball fly before they're forever banned? We here at Solutions of Violence believe our guest today, Michael Negler, has answers to that question.
We are Forward Radio, WFMP 106.5 FM, and you're listening to Solutions of Violence, a program sponsored by Forward Radio. I'm Jim Johnson. Our editor is Carolyn Brooks Johnson. The following is part of WFMP's public affairs educational programming. The views expressed here are those of our guest, not necessarily the views of the station nor its board of directors. If you'd like to share your views, you may contact us by sending us an email to solutionsofviolence18@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Our guest today is Michael Negler. Michael Negler is Professor Emeritus of Classics and Comparative Literature at UC Berkeley, and where he founded the Peace and Conflict Studies Program. Professor Negler has spoken and written widely for campus, religious, public, and special interest groups on the subject of peace and nonviolence for many years. He has consulted with the U.S. Institute of Peace and many other organizations and is president of the board of META, Center for Nonviolence Education, and of PeaceWorks and numerous other boards as well. He has worked in nonviolence intervention since 1970s and served on the interim steering committee of the Nonviolence Peace Force.
In addition to many articles on peace and spirituality, he is the author of America Without Violence, the Upramishan with Syriactic Israel, and most recently, The Search for a Nonviolent Future, which won the 2002 American Book Award and is being used in many courses as well as reading groups around the country. Michael Negler is a student of Syriactic Israel, founder of the Blue Mountain Center of Meditation.
Michael Negler, welcome to Solutions of Violence.
Thank you very much, Jim. And I'd like to just quickly update a couple of things on that bio that you kindly read. I actually retired from teaching at Berkeley way back in 1974. That's exactly 50 years ago. So I haven't been teaching there since then. And most of my work has been through the META Center for Nonviolence that folks, we'll talk later about the website and so forth. But our latest project is called The Third Harmony. And that consists of a book and a film, 45-minute documentary, both called The Third Harmony, and a board game called Cosmic Peace Force. There's other little details, but that will take us there for now.
All right. Michael Negler, you are a professor emeritus of classics and comparative literature at UC Berkeley and the founder of Peace and Conflict Studies Program. How does one transfer from professor of emeritus of classics and comparative literature to director of the Peace and Conflict Studies Program? What does classic and comparative literature have to do with peace and conflict study?
Well, not much, really. It was a question of growth for myself. I think I could call it spiritual growth. You know, the mystics talk about a human being as body, mind, intellect, and spirit. I think by starting a meditation practice, I was able to transition myself from intellect to spiritual practice as the main kind of grounding center of my life. And then I started the Peace and Conflict Studies program as a way to still do something meaningful at the university. And then, of course, in 1974, I took actual retirement and have been working at the META Center, which is an educational organization, but not part of a formal institution like the university.
Okay. So talk about the Peace and Conflict Studies program. Why should UC Berkeley students be interested in peace and conflict studies? Are there opportunities for careers in peace and conflict studies?
Well, I actually didn't like that consideration. I used to point out for students that if we all die, nobody's going to have careers. And I'm not training people for a job. I always used to say that students that we trained in our program which should be capable of going out and creating new jobs. Now, of course, that is somewhat possible because we have something like 60 organizations worldwide who are doing what's called unarmed civilian peacekeeping. It's very challenging, very dangerous, very helpful work where people take nonviolence training and go and intervene in conflict situations, including just this week we were contemplating the possibility of groups operating in Palestine. So to answer your first question, why should students be interested in peace and conflict studies? I'd say because they're human beings. St. Augustine said, by our very nature, we crave peace and harmony with all other human beings as far as we can has reached. So it's a question of really discovering who we are as people.
Okay, fair enough. Talk a little bit more about the Third Harmony Project.
Yeah, the Third Harmony Project, which is about 4 years old now, consists of three deliverables, so to speak. The first to arrive was the book that the Meta Center published through our publishing arm called Person Power Press, emphasizing our focus on the individual. Then we followed that up with a film, and it's just by coincidence, the film editor who worked with us for a year and a half to get that thing done was just visiting our office yesterday. And that both the film and the book are called The Third Harmony, Nonviolence and the New Story of Human Nature. Now, the new story refers to the fact that there's a number of thinkers who are challenging the idea that a human being is primarily a material object, a body, separate from others. And this is being challenged now across the board by people in science, people in the arts, and of course, people in peacemaking and spirituality. That project, as I say, consists of a film which has been used in a number of courses on various levels, and people have used it as fundraisers, organizations have used it, individuals have used it. And if people are interested in it, I think the best way to contact us is info@metacenter.org. The only magic trick you need to know is that Meta has two T's. There's a Meta with one T, they're good friends of ours, but they're a different group.
Okay, I was going to ask you that question. So you're president of the board of Meta Center for Nonviolence Education. So located in Petaluma, California. Tell us about the Meta Center for Nonviolent Education.
Yes, thank you, Jim. We started the Meta Center way back in 1980 when a meditation group that I was meditating with came up with the question, what are we going to do about the violence? And since I was still teaching at that time, I thought of starting what we call a think tank. And so that's how the Meta Center for Nonviolence got started. Later on, a young friend of ours said, we have enough think tanks. What we need now is a hope tank. So we used to have every third Friday, we had a meeting of people that we called a hope tank. We just explore what we call nowadays solutionary approaches to problems, primarily the problem of violence. But Meta also now has a large number of resources that are available for people. Courses, films, children's books, and three books of mine on nonviolence. And we seem to be, you know, very hard at work these days. On Monday, one day alone, I had two major consultations, with one with a group in Palestine and another with a group of people working in El Salvador. So I'm happy to say that, we're getting more and more calls for our various resources, the board game, the courses, the film, and just interviews like this one.
Okay. So our program, Solutions to Violence, is named after the public school education program, Solutions to Violence, quote unquote, established by the Washington Post journalist Colin McCarthy. Does the Meta Center for Nonviolence Education offer services to public schools in Petaluma or elsewhere? We wonder why public schools do not offer classes on nonviolence and conflict resolution.
Yeah, well, that's why I don't teach in the university anymore, because they didn't make it particularly easy for me to teach my nonviolence course, which I thought was the most important thing that I had to offer. And incidentally, Coleman was a good friend of mine, and he gave me a really great start when I wrote my first book on nonviolence. He gave it a great review, and we became very good friends. So this is a serious, serious lack in our educational system, and it's shadowed by a very serious lack in our media. And in fact, it often seems that the media is the dog and the educational system is the tail. I guess I got that wrong. It's the tail that's wagging the dog. It's the media, the mass media, and the educational system follows what teachers and administrators think is going on rather than changing or innovating what's going on. So I got out of formal education, and we have our own radio program and our own blog site and so forth. And of course, through the university, I reached a much larger audience, but it was much more difficult to reach them with the things that I considered most important.
What's the name of the radio program?
It's called Nonviolence Radio, and it comes out of KWMR, which stands for West Marin Radio, down the coast from here. But it is syndicated, and it goes out every other Friday, and it's called, Nonviolence Radio. And my work partner, Stephanie, interviews somebody. Like, for example, recently we interviewed an Israeli Knesset member who was almost impeached because he was so opposed to the war on Gaza and the occupation. His name is Ofer Kassif. So that's half an hour. And then for another half an hour, I do nonviolence news.
Okay. So America Without Violence, Third Harmony, the new story of human nature. Is there no other way? The search for a nonviolent future, the guide for nonviolence, practical action, a handbook, a promise of peace for ourselves and our families and our world. Books all penned by you, Michael Nagler. Let's look at Third Harmony first.
Okay.
You argue that the universe is conscious and purposeful. I'm not sure that Penrose and Harkins would agree with you, but fill us in. Why do you believe that the universe has purpose? If you believe in the Big Bang Theory, the universe appears to be at the mercy of the strong force, the weak force, the electromagnetic force, and the gravitational force. Considering its vastness and its physics, the universe looks randomly organized. Explain it to you.
Well, Mahatma Gandhi would say, who created those forces? Where do they come from? And I think that all forces, even those that manifest in the physical universe, can be rooted in, can be traced back to consciousness. And as Max Planck, the great quantum theorist, said a little over 100 years ago, without consciousness, nothing can be said to exist. So once you recognize that the universe consists of consciousness, or another way of putting that, that the universe consists basically of light, then the whole question of purpose and direction enter in. And I think, especially through Gandhi's eyes, you can see that where the universe is going, you can certainly see this on our planet, is to a condition of higher and higher consciousness. And it's on the threshold of recognizing the unity of life, which some advanced human beings have already recognized. I mean, really advanced human beings like Jesus and Gandhi and people of that caliber. Now, I recently noticed an interesting comparison. The quantum physicist David Bohm stated that the universe is basically frozen light. And one of the Indian spiritual figures that I like very, very much, who inspires me very, very much, Anandamayi Ma, said that everything is light. So what's happening in our era and could possibly be of tremendous significance is that religion, quote unquote, and science, quote unquote, are coming together. What the leading figures in the world of spirituality and the leading figures in the world of science, physical science, are beginning to recognize the same realities from their respective angles. Now, people often ask me, what does the third harmony mean? I can explain that. The Buddha said that we have to establish harmony with the planet, with other beings, and within ourselves. And so the third harmony focuses on that, is the third one, which actually should come first, that we have to establish peace and harmony within ourselves before we can effectively influence the world with it. However much we have progressed in establishing our inner harmony will determine how effective our outer work is going to be. So it's not that we have to be absolutely illumined before we do anything, but the closer to illumination we can get ourselves, through the spiritual practices which have been handed down to us in most of the major religious traditions, the more accurately and effectively we'll be able to work. And so the motto of the Meta Center is helping people practice nonviolence more effectively, more safely, and more effectively. Because we see nonviolence, if you have any kind of spiritual awareness and you want to act on the world, the only way you can do that is through nonviolence.
Okay. So your book, The New Story of Human Nature, argues that humans are spiritual beings and cooperation and collaboration are all natural ways of interacting. But war and violence has been part of human existence since the dawn of civilization, although Gandhi might claim that civilization has yet to occur.
What makes you believe that humans are spiritual beings and that cooperation and collaboration are the human natural way of interacting?
Well, primarily, I'm basing that faith of mine on a kind of inner experience. And secondarily, I think it can be shown that when people cooperate, everything goes much, much better. And when they don't, I'm not talking right now about non-cooperation, which is a kind of cooperation with a higher reality. But when people fight against one another, as we're seeing all over the world, things go much, much worse. And there's various kinds of evidence that when we do that, we're actually going against our deeper nature. For example, there is the phenomenon, a very tragic phenomenon of moral injury, whereby, you know, when people go out and kill others, even if they are told that they're doing something very patriotic and they're heroes and so forth, they come back with grievous forms of PTSD and what is known nowadays as moral injury, where they have injured others physically, but in so doing, they have injured their own psyches. They've injured themselves morally. And so we have a world now where in this country, 20 service members are committing suicide every day. And the military has no answer for that. They don't want to face it, because if they did, they would have to rethink their whole operation. But how we can make use of that is to show that when we hate others and work violence against them, we are violating our own human nature, which the greatest teachers of mankind have been saying forever.
Yeah, let's dig a little deeper into your claim that humans are spiritual beings. An article titled, quote, in the U.S., 47% identify as religious, 33% spiritual, end quote, and penned by Jeffrey M. Jones, published by Gallup News, September 22, 2023, illustrates that, quote, 82% say they are religious, spiritual, or both, end quote. So you're right. The majority of Americans are religious and spiritual, but religious Americans often support war. An article titled, quote, Faith in War, Conflict for Religious Americans, end quote, penned by Jennifer Robinson and published by Gallup News, November 12, 2002, stated, quote, so it appears that religiosity doesn't reduce the appeal of war. In fact, religious fundamentalists are the most likely to support an attack. 63% of people who identify themselves as members of the religious right support war, as do 52% who aren't members of the religious right, end quote. So in the U.S., the majority of folks who support war identify themselves as religious. The Gallup research does not support your position here. So what do you have to say to those statistics?
Well, I would say, first of all, that people who identify themselves as religious are not necessarily truly religious in any meaningful sense. What they mean is that they have a religious institution and a set of external practices, but if those practices fail to give them a lively sense of identity with their fellow human beings, then I'm afraid I would say that that is not a religion. And that also, there is a distinction that can usefully be made between religion and spirituality. Religion is mostly, the way a lot of people understand it, is based on outward practices, and spirituality is based on inward practices, which in our materialistic, externally oriented world are difficult to come by. So if those people declare themselves religious and yet still engage in killing one another, I would say to me that is not a religion in any meaningful sense of the word. And again, I would say it's useful to make a distinction between spirituality, which means deepening our awareness of the unity of life, and religion, which can mean a whole variety of other things, including just identifying with particular groups through by external criteria.
Okay. So, but before we leave this issue concerning connection between spirituality and cooperation, mm-hmm. I have one more question. The sociologist Laura Toussaint, in her book, The Contemporary U.S. Peace Movement, documented specific data based on quantitative and qualitative analysis of self-identified peace activists in terms of their demographic characteristics, motivation for activism, political opportunities, and views of the peace movement. The Toussaint study compiled data that describes the peace and justice movement in the post 9/11 era based on data collected from 251 internet surveys, 33 phone calls. The demographic document that 62.5% were Christian and about 86% identified as connected to some religion. That meant that about 14% did not identify with any religion. I've known atheists and agnostics that were strong peace and justice advocates. What do you say to those statistics?
Well, again, I would say that if you believe with Gandhi, as I do, that religion is, and St. Augustine for that matter, that religion is primarily a matter of recognizing in yourself your unity with other human beings, then to declare yourself as belonging to one particular sect or another becomes irrelevant. And the fact that so many people declare themselves as having a religion, quote unquote, shows that we all need some kind of spiritual grounding. But I'm afraid that for about 2,000 years, the formal religions have failed to really give people that spiritual grounding that they need. I have I developed a theory when I was teaching in religious studies at Berkeley, which I also did, that all religions go through three phases. The first phase is created by a human being whom I call a revelation figure. Of course, the first one that would come to our mind is Jesus of Nazareth. But his vision, though published, is too difficult for most people to follow. So then what happens next is a kind of accommodation where it demands are toned down so the average person can follow them. And then what happens if you go further along the path of this historical trajectory is that very often people go so far from the root meaning of the visionary figure that started the religion that they actually end up in the opposite camp. So you have people all over the world declaring that in the name of their religion, they're going to kill other human beings. So you have so-called Christians, so-called Hindus, so-called Muslims, and even recently so-called Buddhists who are doing this. But that's because it's difficult for us human beings who are involved in the outside world to such an extent and feel so identified with our bodies and feel so out of connection with one another that, we sink down to this, I guess I'm going to use a strong word here, Jim, this degenerate phase of, quote, religion, unquote. And therefore, the statistics don't surprise me on the one hand, but they don't mean a darn thing on the other.
Okay. So your book, The Nonviolent Handbook, is a step-by-step guide to using nonviolence to confront societal problems and build movements capable of restructuring society that would demonstrate peaceful geopolitical regions. Talk to us about the steps for restructuring society, the U.S., for example, so that peace is ubiquitous.
So you want me to, I'm not sure I actually totally remember the seven steps that I published in that book. I might just throw in that since that not too long ago, that in 2014, that book was translated into Arabic, and I actually had the opportunity to hand deliver it to some members of the Hamas leadership, though I don't see that there's been a tremendous effect from that. What I can talk about is the five steps that we developed in the film, Third Harmony, that any person can take. And I think those will actually get us there. So the first step for any ordinary person living today in our industrial societies is to protect your mind from the mass media. They're extremely pernicious and they produce a sense of materialism, separateness, and that inevitably leads to competition and violence. So shut off the TV. And then with the time that you've saved, which in some cases for some teenagers is considerable, then I would say learn everything you can about nonviolence. And that's what the Meta Center is for. That's what all of our resources are geared for. And third step would be, even if you do all of this for your conscious mind, it really is important for you to, if I may use Christian terminology, take care of your soul. So some kind of spiritual practice is necessary. And then figure out what is your best contribution that you can make to peace. Then look at where in the world your particular strengths and weaknesses can be engaged to the best effect and do it. For some people, it may be writing, some people, it may be speaking, others, it may be direct action.
Okay. In your book, America Without Violence, you disagree with the often stated belief that humans cannot change. You explained that mainline news provides evidence that violence is constant, but you explained that mainline news does not produce stories about change that occurs as a result of peaceful demonstrations and pacifist movements. Your book, America Without Violence, discusses the changes that have occurred as a result of revolutions led by pacifists like Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi. You call this the forgotten history, quote unquote. Will knowledge of change that has resulted from peace resolutions and revolutions help the masses understand that a nonviolent world is possible? If so, how do we get that message out to folks, considering that mainline news is not likely to change?
Yeah. Well, today there is a certain amount of alternative news, and if you start looking for it, especially now that we have the internet, you can find, for example, programs like Nonviolence News by Rivera Sun, which is part of the campaign Nonviolence under Pace Bene, the Franciscan peace organization. That's just one example, one of the best, though. This is why we say disengage from the mainstream media as a first thing that you can do to make yourself more effective nonviolently, and then get engaged with nonviolent media, which fortunately are actually happening. Now, in your first question, Jim, it would more like, will knowing about all the nonviolence episodes that have happened help? And I would say that knowledge of the tremendous growth of nonviolence actions in individuals and groups all over the world, something which we never hear about in mainstream media, that tremendous growth, knowledge of it will help. It'll be necessary but not sufficient. We have to go through some kind of, as I tend to call it, some spiritual growth before we can really put it into practice. Sometimes people read about all the bad things that are happening and how the good things that are happening are overlooked, and they get very angry and they rush out and do something destructive and alienating. and even dehumanizing. And so that's why I say knowledge is necessary but not sufficient. What is different in the last 20 years is that a tremendous amount of knowledge is now available to all of us. For example, the work of Erica Chenoweth and Maria Stephan, and Swarthmore College, we now have something called the Global Nonviolent Action Database, which lists over 1,000 campaigns that have been carried out by nonviolent means in the last, I think, 90 or 100 years or so. And as I mentioned before, there are over 60 organizations. Just to mention one kind of nonviolence, which is named unarmed civilian peacekeeping, there's 61 organizations doing that. So we are in a much different position than we were when I wrote America Without Violence, which is, you know, pretty much way back in the past now.
Okay. So, Michael Nagler, as you stated earlier, your book, America Without Violence, explains that U.S. mainland news seldom produces stories about peaceful, successful revolutions. We've noticed that mainland news generally produces stories concerning war from an American exceptionalism, Manichaean perspective, as if the U.S. is always right and totally righteous, even though historians generally compose history concerning war from an objective perspective, pointing out that both sides were guilty of wrongdoings. Medea Benjamin and Nicholas Davis in their book, War in Ukraine, Making Sense Out of a Senseless War, is a good example. Does the fact that the U.S. mainland news generally produces stories concerning war from an American exceptionalism, Manichaean perspective explain the reason why most of the American population initially support war waged by the U.S. military? Should the American population be told the truth concerning war and violence, even though the truth may make the American political leadership look bad?
Well, the simple answer, Jim, is yes. They should be told the truth. You can't have a democracy in which people are constantly lied to. Just yesterday, I had a long interview with my friend Norman Solomon, who lives out here in Inverness, California, and he's a journalist, and he's the head of something called Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And I mentioned to him a book by a Dutch scholar, sociologist, whose name was Rutger Bregman. And I couldn't remember, I don't have it here, I don't think, the exact title of his book, but it's something about human nature. And he cites how time after time, when human beings do things that are selfless and even self-sacrificing, by the time the public hears about it, it's twisted into an entirely different story. For example, you had a film called The Titanic, and in that film, people were represented as being extremely selfish and greedy, and men on this film Titanic were scrambling to get into the lifeboats before other people, including women and children, could do that. But as a matter of fact, on the eastern shore of New Jersey, there is a bronze plaque that was put up by passengers of the Titanic who were rescued, primarily the women. This plaque says, "To the brave men of the Titanic, who gave their lives so that we may live." And story after story after story, human beings behave in a selfless, courageous, nonviolent way, and it gets twisted into the opposite story by the time it reaches the public. Another example in fiction that was very influential was a book called Lord of the Flies, where there was a hypothetical situation of a bunch of teenagers being stranded on a desert island and how they degenerate into savagery and violence. Well, it was recently discovered that a group of teenagers actually did, real teenagers actually were stranded on an island for over a year. And what they did was they started a kind of democratic community. They took care of one another. And once again, the real story of human nature is much more hopeful than the exciting stories that we present to ourselves in the mass media. And that is an extremely harmful procedure. And I really don't know exactly what to do about it, except to keep on producing the positive stories, the truer stories, and trying to get people to pay attention to them.
Okay. So you mentioned Erica Chenoweth and Maria Stephan. So they have a book, Why Civil Resistance Works, The Strategic Logic of Nonviolent Conflict, explains that nonviolent campaigns were twice as likely to be successful as violent campaigns in terms of bringing down oppressive governments. Will getting the Chenoweth-Stephan message out to folks change hearts and minds in terms of considering the possibility of a nonviolent world? What do you think?
At this point, I don't think it will change hearts and minds at a very large scale. As you used to say, as people say, not to where you'd notice it. But it is one piece of the action. It's one important about this book. And I remember Erica reporting about it at a peace meeting many, many years ago, and how thrilled we were to hear her, is that she is the first person in the modern world to use unimpeachable scientific methods to show the effectiveness of nonviolence. She showed that nonviolent insurrections are twice as likely to succeed as violent ones, that they're likely to do this in one-third the time, typically 3 years instead of 9 years, and that they are 10 times more likely to lead to a democratic regime, even if they fail. That is, even if they fail to unseat a dictator, the very fact that nonviolence has been brought out into the open in a society means that they'll be more inclined to create nonviolent political environment for themselves. So this is necessary but not sufficient. It will affect a large number of people. I remember being at a meeting one time in Berkeley where we had a person from the Air Force ROTC speaking, and he said, well, you know, war has been with us ever since there have been human beings. And I quietly got up and said, are you aware that's not true? Have you ever read Maria Gimbutas, about old Europe? And of course, he was absolutely stunned. He had never heard about any such thing. And I can't say that he went and hung up his uniform and resigned from the Air Force, but I could see that he was affected by that truth, by that story, which people, by and large, almost never hear.
So you've talked about this before as well. So if you own a TV, you know about the violent conflict now occurring between Pakistan and Israel, Palestine and Israel. Pacifists like Dr. Ibrahim Iman, Carla Wallace, Dr. Russ Vanderbilt, Madia Benjamin, the international journalist Anatole Levin, who have all appeared on Solutions to Violence, by the way, would love to see a negotiated ceasefire. But they all recognize the fact that the Palestinians have for decades participated in peaceful marches and demonstrations. However, these peaceful demonstrations have done little to diminish the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. An article published by the National Public Radio February 29 explains that the Gaza death toll now surpasses 30,000 people. It doesn't appear that Benjamin Netanyahu is going to agree to a ceasefire anytime soon. Did the Palestinians make a mistake with their demonstrations, like the ones you claim were made in the Tiananmen Square situation? How do the Palestinians free their homeland from Israeli occupation using a nonviolent technique? Is it possible?
Well, I am committed to the belief that it is possible, that they are in a truly drastic situation, one of the worst imaginable, because they are, I think, something like on the order of 5 million Palestinians still living in the West Bank and Gaza. I'm not sure of that number. But they are overwhelmed by American firepower and Israeli brutality. Israelis are so traumatized by their Holocaust experience I'm getting some kind of a message here.
Okay.
So traumatized by the Holocaust that it is nearly impossible to talk to them as a people about nonviolence, and any threat to their physical safety will create this extreme hysterical reaction. And it would take a lot of understanding and trauma healing and humane intervention to get them to tone down that hysteria to where, as a country, as a people, they could elect more rational leaders instead of assassinating them, as they did with Yitzhak Rabin, and make a peace accord with the Palestinians. Now, so I don't think that the Palestinians made a mistake in having peace marches, because I think that no amount of nonviolence ever goes to waste. However, the fact is that a peace march or a protest march is absolutely baby, minimal form of nonviolence. Real nonviolence in that situation would have to mean wholesale civil disobedience, even to the point of accepting martyrdom, because the situation is so drastic. And it would require tremendous training, which is hardly available anywhere in the world. My good friend Mubarak Awad, who started the Palestinian Center for the Study of Nonviolence in Ramallah, he was immediately deported by Israel. So what would have to happen outside Palestine is that America absolutely has to stop providing horrendous weapons or weapons of any kind to the state of Israel. They have to be called to account. They have to be told that being a victim of violence does not give them the carte blanche, the impunity to carry out violence themselves. So take away American weapons and then create some kind of structures in which accommodation can be carried out. One of the things that Ofer Kassif pointed out to us is that here you have Jewish Israelis and Palestinian Israelis passing each other on the street every day, and they don't look each other in the eye. They have not accepted each other as human beings. I actually saw a film, a documentary called Beyond the Green Line, in which one Israeli just literally said, they are not human beings. When you sink to that level of dehumanization, the first thing you have to do is get back out of it through education and raising of consciousness before you can hope to do anything political. So I really have nothing to say about whether it should be a one-state solution or a two-state solution or however it should be organized politically. I haven't really got an opinion on that. But I do have a very strong opinion that people are going to have their dignity respected and their livelihood guaranteed. Their capacity to lead a human existence has to be there, and then progress can be made towards some kind of sustainable solution.
META, Center for Nonviolent Education, is one of many peace and justice organizations that came into existence during and after the Vietnam War. Clergy concerned about Vietnam, Students for a Democratic Society, the New Left, the War Resistance League, the Fellowship of Reconciliation, the U.S. Central American Peace Movement, Witness for Peace, Cold Pink, World Beyond War, Physicians Opposed to Nuclear Weapons, U.S. Institute for Peace, Veterans for Peace. All of these are peace and justice institutions in most universities as well, all over the United States. Peace and justice institutions that exist in most countries in the world. But war and violence still occur. Is there evidence that demonstrates that peace organizations are effectively diminishing war and violence?
I don't know the answer to that question. That would be more for Erica and Maria and people like that. I do know that we have so far failed to make a significant impact on the mainstream consciousness. You list out the name of a lot of different organizations, but even if you added up all the membership of all those organizations, it would not be a fraction of 1% of the population of this country. And more to the point, their access to mainstream media is practically nothing. So that's the situation has to change. These organizations have to grow dramatically. There are a couple of encouraging signs. One is that there's a tendency nowadays for these groups to form coalitions, and that makes them much more effective than when they're just operating independently. And another is they have this new institution. It isn't really new, but it's in terms of its public awareness, it is new, that we call unarmed civilian peacekeeping, which can have dramatic results. And I think if you had one peace intervention that made a dramatic difference in a conflict that was in the public eye, like Palestine or Ukraine right now, and if you could wave a magic wand and get major news media to cover it, that it could be the spark plug of a real revolutionary change. So all I say is, inshallah, I hope that such a thing will happen. And it'd be nice if it happened in my lifetime, but they haven't got much time to do that.
So the Catholic priest, as you know, Reverend John Deere, is currently conducting a book tour. He will be in Louisville, Kentucky, here, April 11th, 7 p.m. at Louisville's Earth and Spirit Center behind St. James Church on Newburgh Road. As you know, John Deere is a nationally known peace activist who also is a popular author, retreat leader, and lecturer on peace and justice issues. John Deere's newest book, The Gospel of Peace, a commentary on Matthew, Mark, and Luke from the perspective of nonviolence. Explain to us why John Deere is somewhat controversial from the perspective of other Catholic priests and some clergy.
Well, this would go back to the model that I elaborated earlier, the trajectory of most religions. If there is a book, for example, by a fellow named Jeffrey Nuttall called Christian Pacifism in History, and he shows that on five different occasions, gospel nonviolence was rediscovered, but it has yet to really have an impact on the mainstream. And I think even someone who is a Catholic priest or a rabbi, a Jewish rabbi or a Protestant minister, they have to talk to people who have been indoctrinated to believe that they are separate and they have to compete against others for their well-being, if not their very life. So the revelations of the great spiritual figures, even though they are being echoed by people like John Deere, they don't really have much of a purchase on public consciousness. And that probably is not terribly different, even for those who identify as religious and have a religious vocation. Nuttall's book makes it quite clear that the gospel and its nonviolent message have been rediscovered as he says, in five major episodes since the time of Jesus, but none of them has yet really got a purchase on society as a whole. However, again, I am absolutely sure that none of that activity has gone to waste. And at some point, there will be when the sixth episode happens, or the seventh or the eighth, the rediscovery of gospel nonviolence, that it may actually catch on. I think what's different now is we have the tremendous impact of Gandhi, and it can be understood and people can be educated about it. You talk to a lot of people today about Gandhi. I've had this experience and they've never heard of him. They don't know who you're talking about. So if a message of people that caliber and then people who follow them with heart and soul the way John Deere does, if their message gets more well known, and it will happen in time. It just, who knows whether it'll be enough time to really head off some of the major disasters that we seem to be sliding towards at this point.
Okay. I know that this claim is anecdotal, but after decades of attending Methodist and Catholic churches, I have yet to hear a reference to the Sermon on the Mount. As you know, the Sermon on the Mount parenthetically states, "It is written, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I saith unto you, turn the other cheek. Love thy neighbor as thyself. Love thy enemy." Why is the Sermon on the Mount controversial among conservative Christian churches?
Well, you are right, Jim. This is the question that we've been addressing all along. The Sermon on the Mount is the quintessential message of Jesus, who by any measure you have to recognize as one of the greatest religious teachers of humanity. And again, it's too much for most human beings to feel that they can measure up to. And I think in the modern period with the modern mass media, it's become harder than ever.
Yeah, I had a conversation with a priest in the local church here, St. Bernard's, about that same topic. He said, "Well, Jim, you're exactly right. But if I spend too much time preaching the social gospel and peace here at St. Bernard's, I'm going to lose half my congregation, and I literally can't afford to do that."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, Dr. Michael Nagler, we are about out of time here. Do you have any last-minute thoughts that you'd like to share with our listeners? Is there hope for a more peaceful world?
There is always hope. As long as there are human beings, there's hope for change. I've devoted my life to trying to provide the resources by which people who are inclined to change could act in most effective way possible. So I will never give up hope on human beings. Gandhi said no one can dogmatize about human nature. Our possibilities have just barely begun to be realized in terms of peace and brotherly love. And the values that Jesus so beautifully and eloquently gave us in the Sermon on the Mount and elsewhere. So, yes, I have hope, and I would like to, again, just to refer people to our website, metacenter.org, meta with two T's. And if you want to get in touch with us, it's info@metacenter.org. And if you want to go right to the film and the other resources, you can also look up thirdharmony.org. And that in the modern style, Third Harmony and Meta Center are respectively one word apiece. So we would be happy to hear from people who want to pursue this further. I've been talking nonstop, it seems, practically all week. And it makes me feel useful and feel that I have done the best. I recently read something in Gandhi that struck me very much. Of course, for him, it was on a much greater scale. But he said that he has been given a tremendous gift to deliver to mankind, namely nonviolence, and that if he does not demonstrate it in his life and his teachings, as he said, God will not forgive me. Well, I can't compare myself to him, to anyone on that scale, but I do feel that every one of us has been given a capacity to develop nonviolence within him or herself, and that we will really not ever feel self-realized until we've done it. So that's what I would leave your audience with, Jim, and I just want to thank you very, very much for giving me this opportunity to speak.
All right. The Solution to Violence program that features Dr. Michael Nagler will air again April 9th and 10th. You can listen to live stream if you visit us at forwardvideo.org and click on Listen Live Now. You can also listen via our archives if you visit our website, scroll down to Program Archives, and then scroll down to the Solution to Violence program that features Dr. Michael Nagler. Solution to Violence airs on Mondays at 5 p.m., Tuesdays at 8 a.m., and Wednesdays at 6 a.m.
Before we leave you today, we want to put in a plug for Forward Radio. March 30th begins our yearly pledge drive. WFMP 106.5 FM is a non-commercial FM radio station. We feature 12 national programs like the Ralph Nader Hour, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, Law and Disorder, and Economic Update. We also feature 23 local programs like the Climate Report, Sustainability Now!, On the Edge with K.A. Owen, Truth to Power, power, critical thinking for everyone, and solutions abound. All of this comes to you commercial-free. We can do this because all of our producers, as well as our staff and board of directors, are volunteers. We do need a revenue stream to keep the lights on. We have studio rent to pay, equipment to purchase and maintain, and licenses to purchase. So we do need your help. We want to tell you about our WFMP Pledge Drive. Our Pledge Drive begins March 30th and culminates in our Forward Radio Party April 13th. So this announcement is in part a mark your date request. We want to invite you to our birthday party. WFMP 106.5 FM wants to celebrate 7 years of on-the-air community all-volunteer radio. To celebrate that occasion, we are planning an in-person party to be held in the Logan Street Market, located 1001 Logan Street. There will be food and drinks served by the Logan Street Market, special guests, music, and concert dance. The celebration begins at 5 p.m. April 13th. You're invited. This year, our goal is to raise $7,000. You can donate by visiting our website at forwardradio.org and clicking on Donate. There will be gifts for generous donations. We will be gifting t-shirts, hoodies, calendars, coffee mugs, all featuring our WFMP 106.5 logo. You can donate right now. Simply visit our website at forwardradio.org and click on Donate. So help us stay on the air. Your generosity will be greatly appreciated.
Carolyn Brooks Johnson is our editor for Solutions to Violence and WFMP Radio. I'm Jim Johnson. Thanks for listening.